Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 3, delivered on January 19, 2016. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates.
Today, interest rates. Now, interest rates are discussed at a number of points in the book, but there's not a consolidated approach in one place to what constitutes an interest rate and the structure of an interest rate and how critical interest rates are to business. That whole thing about interest rates is sort of like the driving force in Western capitalism underlying all of our decision making in business. But I want to do something here. Madam, I should like to borrow from you $100 today, and I'll give you $100 back in a year. Is that okay? Dear God, woman, you're a capitalist. I take $100 from you today, and I give you $100 back in a year. Is that reasonable to you?
I'd want some more.
More? Well, how much more? Well, no, tell me how much I have to give you back.
150?
That's 50% interest, my God! Wow, 50. Asshole. No, well, okay, you see the point, though, that you deserve compensation for giving up your money. But the thing is that compensation actually has different parts to it. At the heart of every interest rate, at the rock bottom, is a reward just purely for giving up consumption now. That is what we call the real interest rate. It is the opportunity cost of foregone immediate consumption. The opportunity cost of foregone immediate consumption. The real interest rate. You've got to get something, because otherwise you could go out with that money and buy a cheeseburger tonight and eat it. You'd have it now instead of in a year. You see, so I've got to give you some kind of a reward for giving up your money now because you could use it now. That's just the bottom. That's the very essence of all interest rates. It's underneath every other interest rate. Now, interestingly enough, though, that rock bottom, that opportunity cost of foregone consumption, is something we can't see. It's not there posted on some financial news site. It's not sitting there as the yield on some debt instrument. It's hidden. It's sort of like under the surface. Similarly, in such a field like quantum mechanics, we know that there's something called a gluon, but we do not ever see them because they don't exist naked. And the real interest rate that R sub, or I guess books now use K for interest rates, K sub real, it's there. We know it's there, but it's just hidden because it's always blended with at least one other thing, usually with a bunch of other things, and I'll talk about those in order. But there's one thing that it's always going to be blended with. That one, here's the thing, okay. I hired you full time, and your pay, I'm a very generous employer, $100 a week, that's what I pay. call me, a great guy. Okay. Now, after a year, you come into my office for your annual review, and I say, you've been doing damn well this year. Well, inflation was running at 2%, and you've done such a good job. I'm going to boost you up to $102. I'm going to give you a 2% raise in your income. Okay? So you walk out of the office, you're feeling great. It's another two bags of ramen noodles tonight for you. Yeah. Great thing I did there. Well, the next year, you come in for the annual review, and I said, you're still doing great. Let's see, inflation running this year at 4%. I'm going to give you a 4% increase this year. Inflation ran 4% this past year, so I'm going to give you a 4% increase. There you go. There's your damn raise. Now go get back to work. Next year, you come in. And I'm like, well, looks like inflation has been running at about 6%. So I'm going to give you a 6% raise. There's your damn raise. There are two things wrong with what I'm doing. One is obviously there's no merit increase granted. But actually, there are three things wrong. The merit's out there. But there are two other things wrong that are more fundamental to finance. You might not see them right off the bat, but here's one of them. I am giving you that first 2%. Well, inflation already went 2%. So I'm not giving you something for the future. I'm compensating you. You've already been hit by the 2% inflation, and I'm rewarding you afterwards. That's like punching you in the face and then giving you some aspirin after I've done it, or giving you a face mask. You see, that inflation rate already happened. There's another thing going on, too, though, that's sort of related to that, but not exactly the same thing. There was 2% inflation last year, so I gave you 2% at the end of the year. 4% last year, so I gave you 4% at the end of this year. 6%, so I gave you 6%. What should you want me to give you for this coming year? 6%? Or maybe... Well, no, not above. Well, not above inflation. See, there's the thing. We in finance don't give a rat's ass about inflation. What we care about is expected inflation. If inflation went 2%, 4%, 6%, you don't want a 6% raise. You would want 8% maybe or something like that. Because the future is all that matters. Remember what I told you in finance about the past? Where is the past? It's dead. It's gone. It's with Jesus now. We don't care about the past. So in other words, in every interest rate that is charged, there is embedded, tied to that real interest rate, an expected inflation premium. An expected inflation premium. In other words, if we expect inflation to be 8% next year, we're going to put an extra 8% pad on any interest rate that we charge. Because otherwise, we lose to inflation. If I see inflation this year at 2%, but I think it's going to be 8% next year, I'm not going to charge you 2% extra inflation. I'm going to charge you 8% because that's what I see the future holding. There's a related idea in cost that I wanted to get to, and I usually do it either the first day or I do it at this point. Remember I told you what in finance are important costs? Do you remember what is an important cost in finance? Yes, that's a very important cost. It's opportunity cost. And one of those indirect or hidden costs that they mention. But there's actually another cost that is very important in finance and in business in general, in the reality of business. And it's related to what I've just been talking about with inflation. You, sir, were going to be a business major. You thought, this is the life, I'm going to work in one of those high-rise skyscrapers in downtown Chicago, and I'm going to live the life. But somewhere one night, you have a dream of a completely different life, and it hits you, yes, that's what I want to do. I want to own my own little gas station on the outskirts of Memphis. So you drop out of college. You buy that little tiny gas station, one of those little kiosks. You change your name to Earl so you can wear a shirt that says Earl on it in an oval. You buy a pair of pants when you bend over, your crack shows. And you start running your gas station. Well, every week the cocaine driver comes through and he sells you gasoline. Now, there are other gas stations all down the line. You all charge about the same price. It's fairly competitive. Charge more, you won't get any business. Charge less, everyone will take your business. Take your gas and then go on to the next one. So everyone has about the same price. So the Coca-Lean truck comes in, and it hits you at $1.40 a gallon. You notice that about everyone marks up 20 cents on $1.40. So you mark up to $1.60. And you wave to the Coca-Lean driver, and then you grab yourself a Snickers candy bar from the shelf, and then go back and squat down in your little hut back there with your black and white TV. And something strange happened. Now, you were watching when you left to talk to the Coca-Lean driver. You were watching Rachel Ray, okay? But when you sit back down, there's news bulletins and these pictures. And you see warships in a mushroom cloud, for God's sake. And there are a picture of a giant battleship sinking. And there's news streamers saying Iran has been attacked. Nuclear bombs have been dropped on manufacturing for nuclear materials manufacturing in Iran, near Tehran, and near several other cities. Iran has responded by mining the Gulf of Hormuz, and it has fired silkworm and sunburn missiles, and it has made a direct hit on three battleships of the United States. European allies in NATO are now fielding bombers headed for Iran, and Iran has launched three Mark IV missiles that have a range that can reach Paris. Now, by the time that Coca-Lean driver gets to the next gas station down the road, the price of gas that he's charging is not $1.40. The price of gas he's charging is $8.40. Okay. So you look down the line as the Coca-Lean driver goes along, and you see all of their prices going to $8.60, all of these gas stations. You got lucky before the Coca-Lean driver got the signal to up the price. Okay, so you're looking at your sign, $1.60. You see their sign's $8.60. What are you going to do?
$6 or $7.
No, you're not. You're going to raise it to $8.60. Why not less? Well, because you can sell it at $8.60. Everyone else sells at $8.60. You can too. There's plenty of business. There was business before. There'll be business now. Why is he going to jack his price up? He got his gas at $1.40. Is he some kind of running capitalist pig dog? Yes. But why is he going to raise his price when he didn't have to pay that cost?
Because he can.
Well, yes. But there's something even more important. Replacement cost. What's going to happen the next time he has to buy gas and that sorry son of a bitch was charging $1.60 a gallon and the Coca-Lean truck comes back and by that time it's $10 a gallon? Do you understand? The replacement cost is all that matters. Not the cost that he paid for it. It's the cost of the expected next round. There's that expectation again, driving us in business. We can't charge historical cost. We have to charge expected future cost. Because it's the future that is where you will have to buy that next load of gasoline. Anything below the 860, you're having an expectation that probably is not going to come through. You're having an expectation that the market all the way down that road doesn't have. That's why you tend to see going with the herd. Because if you go somewhere besides where the herd's going, here's something I found out when I was watching wild animals. If you're a rebel, you decide that you're that gazelle that's going to go where all the other ones don't go. You know what they call you? Lunch. Lunch for the cats, the big kitties. And they are not loll cats. Well, they're lolling because this idiot went off from the herd. You see, you're going to stay with the expectation of the herd. You understand that? That's the whole point that I'm trying to get to with this expectation. We don't care about what has happened. We care about what we expect to happen. We have no crystal ball. We don't know the future. But unfortunately, that's where we're headed. So we have to form an expectation of it. This bites really hard. Sometimes it turns into a real problem. You see, back in the... In the 1970s, the Federal Reserve was just printing money hand over fist, and inflation just kept going up and up because printing money, too much money, is what causes inflation. Nothing else creates inflation. It's printing too much money that causes inflation. All these other things, well, corporations jacking up their prices, that causes inflation, or unions there cause bullshit. The only thing that creates inflation is printing too much money, printing money faster than the growth rate of the economy. So this was going on all through the 70s. I mean, it was really going on in the 60s, too. And one president after another swore to God, we're going to stop this. Gerald Ford said, we're going to whip inflation now. He had these wind bumper buttons. And then Jimmy Carter came into office, and he said, I see inflation as the moral equivalent of war. Unfortunately, the acronym for that is MEOW. But Carter was not an idiot. He was very well trained. He was a nuclear engineer. He was very well trained, and he knew what was really going on. It was the money supply. And so... what happened, he bit the bullet in 79 and he appointed a head of the Federal Reserve, and I'll talk more about this on Thursday. He appointed a head of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, who just didn't care about humans. He cut the money supply, he just like that. He said, nope, it's over. Well, of course, we've been hearing that for years and years, and no one believed it. Banks didn't believe it. Interest rates still had this massive expected inflation premium because no one believed that it was going to happen. He really was going to do it. And of course, because he cut the supply of money went down, so the real interest rate skyrocketed, and that expected inflation premium was still parked there on that thing. So you had mortgage rates going into 25% range. There were corporate bonds being issued with coupons of 30% and stuff like that. You see, because the expectation of continued hyperinflation was still there. And it was only after Volcker had pretty much killed the economy. Do you believe me now? Okay. Do you believe me now? Do you believe me? Oh, okay. After about 2 years of this, finally, the markets, oh, I guess the son of a bitch is serious. And the economy spiraled into this recession. And of course, Carter was kicked out of office. He lost the election to a fellow named Ronald Reagan, and because of that, you couldn't explain to people what had happened. So Carter ended up being a one-term president. But the deal is that expectation is there, and it bites us. Sometimes it's really hard to get an expectation out of you. Someday you will be married. And you will be unfaithful to your spouse. Now, a day after you are unfaithful, she's found out. She's not stupid. You come home with that shit-eating grin on your face. Now, is she going to? And you say, "I'm never going to do it again." Will she believe you? Oh hell no! No, you don't have that kind of face. She's going to look at your lying face eyes. Okay, it'll take years. You see, that's that expectation coming through again. In our lives, we base actually what we do on expectation. And I got to emphasize that here because it is crucial that you understand that historical data might give us some kind of a clue about the future, especially when you look at trends. But that is not the future, and that's where we have to make our form our expectations. So, the very first interest rate that we would ever see is what is what we call the risk-free rate, which is the real rate plus the expected inflation premium. The real rate plus the expected inflation premium. That's called the risk-free rate of return. It's actually very important in finance. It's sort of like that substrate. Every interest rate will park on this risk-free rate. Every interest rate you ever see will park on that risk-free rate. There we go. I thought I hid some paper back here. So I'm going to turn this thing on here. Seriously? Is there some reason this sucks? Oh. Don't just stand there. Someone tell me how, what the hell? Oh. Oh. They put a new one in here, and so there. Yeah. Now, document camera. Doc camera. On. On. Really? Oh, I guess I should turn on the projector. Too. Okay. While that's warming up, I'm just going to write down that little formula, a couple more here. We actually don't see the risk-free rate as a pure theoretical animal. We don't see it. It's a theoretical construct. However, this one, we have particularly one debt instrument that we use as the proxy for it because it's got to be very close to the pure theoretical risk-free rate of return. Bear with me here while I grab a pen. Okay. So the first thing that let me write down is that risk-free rate, R sub F. Oh, I'm sorry. Books these days are using the K for interest rates, and I'm still back in the old days when K sub R. The risk-free rate is the real rate of return, and we usually designate the expected inflation premium with the Greek letter pi with the superscript e. Okay, that's the risk-free rate. Now again, I will repeat. The real rate of return is the rental rate of money to reward for foregone consumption. The expected inflation premium is the reward for the expected erosion of purchasing power. Put those together and you get the first interest rate that we could estimate fairly easily. What do we use for it? A very short-term treasury bill. Because it's a treasury bill, as I had mentioned in the last lecture, a treasury bill is riskless. And so on a very short one that wouldn't have other risk premia in it that I'll talk about in a minute here, we figure that whatever that yield is on a treasury instrument, that's probably the one that we are, that's probably pretty close to that risk-free rate. Okay, so now, that is just like only one interest rate. Now I'm going to write a K. Sub D. That's an interest rate on some debt instrument. It doesn't necessarily have to be a debt instrument. The one thing that you probably already know is that there is not something called the interest rate. There are lots of interest rates. There's an interest rate on a car, a loan. There's an interest rate on a home mortgage. There's an interest rate on a credit card. There's an interest rate on a student loan. As a matter of fact, there's actually an interest rate associated with stock investing. Cost of capital, cost of equity capital, we call it. There's an interest rate that you would expect to earn on an investment. There are all kinds of interest rates out there. At the bottom of every one of those, though, is this risk-free rate. Simply because you could avoid all risk and just put all your money into treasury bills, buy at the government auctions. So every interest rate would have to have as its substrate this risk-free rate. It has to be there. And so wherever that treasury bill goes, we know that interest rates are probably going to go up and down with it to some extent. Now, some interest rates are set with this risk-free rate, the treasury bill rate, plus something. Others are set with some other basic kind of interest rate, like LIBOR or the Fed funds rate or something like that. But whatever it is, underneath every interest rate is this risk-free rate. And then there is, on top of that, what makes interest rates different from one another is a complex of three pieces called the risk premium of an interest rate. Every interest rate has its own combination of these three, and that's why you'll see different interest rates for different things. The first one. A default premium. A default premium. A reward for taking the risk that part or all of the payments will not happen. The reward for bearing the risk that part or all of the payments back to the investor won't happen. The default premium is zero on a government instrument. The government will pay you back, so there's no default premium. But let's talk about default premiums. High or low, would the default premium be, in your judgment, would the default premium be high or low, let's say, on a home mortgage? The interest rate that's on a home mortgage, would it have a high default premium piece, or would it have a low? Believe it or not, it's actually quite low for two reasons. First is that a home loan, the mortgage debt security, is asset-backed. There's a house there that you can get back. So even if you decide not to pay your payments and it comes back to me, the banker, at least I've got a house that I can sell. The second reason is, and most people just still don't know this, is that banks require that any home that is any home loan with a loan to value above 80%, part of your payment every month is for mortgage insurance, so that if you default, then the bank has an insurance policy that pays the difference between what the balance of the loan is and what they get for it when they sell the house. The bank unloads the house. Most people have no idea that they're actually paying. The bank cries, "Crying! Look at all these loans we lost. We lost so bullshit. They didn't lose anything because the people who were making the payments were paying them an insurance policy to protect the bank." Interestingly enough, the law requires that you pay this as long as your loan to value ratio is above 80%. Most people never go to the bank. They're paying on their loan for years. The balance goes down, down, down. They don't know that they could go to the bank and say, "Take off that mortgage insurance. You can't charge it to me anymore." Virtually no one walks in. I've talked to people. I've consulted people. The greatest example, this couple was down near 30% on loan to value, and they had been paying this insurance premium for easily 10 years that they didn't have to every month an insurance premium to protect the bank in the event of a default. So the default premium on a home loan is actually not too bad. What about a credit card loan? Oh yeah, that no asset backing, and you know, if you're like me, a credit card statement I owe this month, you know, that's the later. Okay, how about a student loan? What would you say, high or low default premium? Yeah, it is. For one thing, back before the government took over the program, the government was backing them to begin with. And besides which, if you don't make your payment, they'll send a wet team rappelling from black helicopters and they will seize your assets. Okay? They're going to get their money back from you. So the default premium is actually quite low. Now, a car loan on a new car, it's kind of intermediate. First of all, it's a back loan. It's asset-backed. So that means that it's not going to be sky-high. However, the general rule is that when you drive your car off the lot, a new car off the lot, it immediately drops in value. So if you default, there's almost a guarantee that there's going to be a gap between what they can resell it for and what you owe on it. So there would be an intermediate level of a default premium. So you see right there, that default premium sort of begins to shape why we see different interest rates on different types of debt instruments. The next one is a little more complicated. R sub M. This is the maturity premium. This is one, and I'll use the example of a bank that makes a home loan. This is a double downside for a lender. It's a double upside for a borrower. So the lender is going to whack you. The longer the loan is, the bigger this maturity premium will be. Here's how it works. You look like a respectable guy. You wear a tie. A yellow tie, but it's still a tie. But the deal is this. You buy a home, 30-year mortgage. Now, what happened? You borrow the money, let's say 8% APR, fixed rate loan. Now, after about, let's say, 5 years, 10 years, interest rates fall. And you're seeing mortgages, new mortgages, at 5% on homes. What are you going to do? Bingo. You're going to refi it like a boss. You're not going to wait. You're not going to hang around with an 8%. So in other words, the bank, which had expected to get 30 years of money at 8%, is suddenly going to get that money back, and it can lend it out only at 5%. You'll do that to them. Okay? So you got a downside for a bank. It's going to have to watch you for that. But then there's an upside. I bet you didn't know it, but on average, the average homeowner, especially first-time buyer, stays in the house of first purchase about 7 years. So here you are. Now, you're married, and after about 7 years, you decide that you are fertile of loin, and you decide to have children. 3. 5. 8? Oh, damn, boy. Okay, now, the thing, though, is, now, normally, at about 7 years, you're going to sell that house and buy a new house. But what happens if interest rates go to 15% on new home mortgages? Yeah, just dig some holes in the basement and say, there you are, kids, there's your cavern. Sleep there. Okay? See, what'll happen is, I'm a banker. I would really love to have that money back so I can lend it out at the prevailing 15. You're not going to do that to me. I might even say, hey, listen, it's 7 years. Maybe you want to start looking at another house, and you're going to look at the interest rate of 15%, and you're going to say in your most diplomatic voice, kiss my ass. No. You see, so there's any kind of interest rate volatility will be to my disadvantage as the lender. So the longer any loan is, the more likely there is to be an up or down on interest rates. It doesn't matter which, I'm screwed either way. So this maturity premium is there simply because it's a longer loan. The longer the loan, the more that maturity premium is. And the more expectation of interest rate volatility, the bigger that maturity premium will be. In other words, if I'm a banker and I see a smooth, interest rates are going to stay nice and calm for years to come, I might shave off, I might not be so bad on that maturity premium. But if I see turbulent interest rates ahead, whipsawing up, down, all around, sideways, then I'm probably going to have that maturity premium be higher at all terms of loans. Okay? So, the maturity premium, interestingly enough, you will see no default premium in a government debt instrument, like 30-year bonds, but you will see the maturity premium, that expectation of interest rate volatility showing up. Now, the next one. Now, I used to call this, and for a time immemorable, I've used the term liquidity premium. The book uses the term illiquidity premium. You see, most loans that we take out, most loans, the originator might want to sell it. Look, I might... Well, here's the reality of it. With home mortgages, a bank will lend you the money. That loan will be packaged up and sold to these massive secondary mortgage market pools within hours. No bank keeps its loan. It's just essentially a pass-through agent. Mortgages are very high-quality instruments, usually, except for that high-risk market. And so they'll take in, like, 30 loans in a couple of days, they'll just bundle them up and they'll sell them to Ginnie Mae or Fannie Mae. And Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae will put them all together, rip them apart into what part is payments, what part is early payoff, what part is just normal payoff, and they'll sell them to different massive investment groups all over the world. But the bottom line is that those loans, the bank can dump its loans within minutes if it wants to, if it doesn't want to. Similarly, car loans are a little bit more difficult to package up. Student loans, there used to be a huge market. They'd make all the student loans to you guys. Have you been in school long enough to have taken out a student loan through a bank by any chance? Well, back the banks used to do the loans. They were backed by the government, the National Direct Student Loan Program, and all that kind of stuff. Well, what the banks would do is they'd have that surge of students they'd make the loans to, and then they'd just package them up and sell them to these big a company called Sallie Mae that put them into giant packages and sold them to investors as a single, massive, multi-hundred-of-million-dollar debt instruments. And then they would invest in them. That market was highly liquid. The banks knew they'd make the loans right away because they didn't have a loan for more than a little bit before they unloaded it. They were highly liquid instruments. Remember that term liquidity I used? They were highly liquid. Some things aren't liquid, though. Some things... Once you've got it, you make some kinds of loans. I mean, you're stuck with that loan for a while. Personal loans. Banks, when they make those personal loans, they're probably kind of stuck with those for a while. That's why you'll have higher interest rate on a personal loan from a bank than you would on a car loan, or a especially on a mortgage loan, a home mortgage loan, because they are not as easy for the bank to get rid of. There's an illiquidity. Now, on the equity side, I could give you a story like that, too. When an investment banking group sells stock in, like, a Facebook, they know darn well that they buy the stock from the company. They know they'll be able to sell it within seconds. There's no liquidity premium. I ran a penny stock house many, many years ago. And I mean, the big thing was, if I took inventory of some company that was going public, I took some inventory for my own account, I had no idea when I was going to be able to sell that stuff. So I had to sell that stuff. I had to buy it at very low prices. And they said, why are you buying it from us at a low price? We paid more for I don't know when I can sell this. It's going to take me forever to find some sucker or some investor to buy this stock back up. And that's what happens. One of the things about penny stocks is the reason they're so low in price is because they've got that nasty little liquidity premium in them that makes them less valuable than mainstream first-tier stocks. So there you go. That is an interest rate. We call this the risk premium, the three pieces, the risk premium. And how those pieces are put together, the numbers that are actually there in real life, are what we call the risk structure of an interest rate. They're called the risk structure. Now, interestingly enough, different interest rates will tend to move together. The risk structures tend to stay stable relative to each other, but they don't always. Sometimes one piece of the risk structure will get out of whack from the others for certain types of debt instruments. Now, what I'm going to show you here is what is called a yield curve. It is the yield on federal debt instruments of different maturities. It's a window on the world. Did you ever want to predict the future?
Of course.
Well, yeah, I know that. Powerball, $1.3 billion. You know what I got out of 20 of 10 tickets? $4. The hell with that. Look. Yeah. It was one sandwich at Chick-fil-A. There's a place, this is sort of like, it's not the future, but it's one of the best ways that we can see what the financial markets view as the expected future. Because these are treasury debt instruments. The ones real close in are short-term borrowings by the government. The ones way out there are long-term borrowings by the government. The government borrows at all kinds of different terms based upon what the money that they're borrowing is needed for. Long-term capital projects, money to pay the light bill at the White House, whatever, if it's small. Okay, so you notice that the yield curve arches upward. There would be only one thing that could cause the yield curve to arch upward on government debt instruments. That would be the maturity premium. That is actually a relatively healthy-looking yield curve. It's arching upward. Now, if it was arching upward very dramatically, that would mean that there was a very substantial maturity premium, meaning that the markets deemed that there was they expected a high degree of interest rate volatility in the future. The problem, though, is that if the yield curve flattens out too much, that can be a concern, too. Because the maturity premium should not flatten too much. There's one thing that can be an absolute disaster. It's what's called an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve would happen if some interest rate at a longer period were below an interest rate that was shorter, a yield that was shorter. So in other words, if you saw this dip and then come back up, that would be an inverted yield curve. Here's the thing. Every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve, at least for a temporarily inverted yield curve. Now, sometimes we have seen inverted yield curves and a recession did not happen. But every recession that has happened has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. Now, here's the story behind my own work in this. I wrote on a website for many years. It was followed by a lot of people. And on there, I wrote about economics. I wrote it for thinking people who didn't know economics, but I'd explain economic concepts. And I talked about the state of the economy. I got into politics and social things, too. Eventually, I pissed off too many wrong people, and my site was destroyed. But back in the day, in the around 2007, I believe it was, I started warning that there were very bad signs that there was going to be a serious economic crisis and a financial crisis. And I was called a conspiracy theorist. I was deemed a nutcase. I tried to show the data that I was looking at. Investment in the first years of the 21st century had collapsed. It was half, business investment was half of what it had been in the 1990s. The Federal Reserve was following a policy that was completely bizarre. I'll talk about that on Thursday too. And there was so much politics and spite. But I was watching the yield curve, and I was posting every now and then. I was saying, all right, look at the yield curve. It was getting flatter and flatter in the 7 to 10 year range. It just kept getting, but it wasn't inverting. And so I couldn't call, here's a recession happening. The crisis is about to happen. Well, in the early part of 2008, one morning, there was a technical inversion at seven to 10. The 7 was below the 5. The 10 was above the 7. It was just barely there. I mean, it was just like a couple, maybe 20 basis points. In other words, 0.2% of percent. But it was there. I said, that's it. There's going to be a recession. Interestingly, within hours, it came back up, so the inversion had evaporated. But it did the inversion, and I called it. I wrote my last article in June of 2008. The title was The Gospel of Impending Doom, saying it's going to happen now. And, of course, I was the conspiracy theorist, and they laughed their asses off at me, at the Fed, and things like that. Well, we had it on September the 15th of 2008. It was in the morning. When the sun was coming up on the East Coast, the Federal Reserve banks, the big Federal Reserve Bank is the Bank of New York, called the Empire Bank. Talk about it on Thursday. But at the Empire Bank, they were tracking money flows in and out. They do that. They watch the whole economy, and they got good computers. And they were noticing that there were abnormally large withdrawals of funds from money market accounts. As the banks were opening, just right off the bat, there were these withdrawals that were large withdrawals, substantial. Also interesting was that it was difficult to track who was withdrawing and where these accounts were based, but the draws were pretty severe. By the time it was 10 o'clock on the East Coast, the banks were opening up along the way through the continent. The withdrawals had gotten to the point where they had reached $550 billion in money market money had been withdrawn. Where it was going, no one knew, but it was being withdrawn by very large investors, pulling money out of money market accounts. Essentially, at 10 o'clock, there was a critical meeting of the Federal Reserve Board, and they declared a suspension of all withdrawals from money market accounts above certain amounts. They just simply said, it's got to stop. Because if they hadn't stopped it within 2 hours, the entire financial system of the world would have collapsed. It would have been financial apocalypse. That afternoon, a special session of Congress was called as one of the members of the House of Representatives of the Times, Jeff Sessions, said to the then-chairman, Nancy Pelosi, Madam Chairwoman, are we under martial law in this House? She did not answer him. They had closed the doors, and they had had to have a solution. The Treasury Secretary at the time, Hank Paulson, was there. The head of the New York Bank, Gaitner, was there, Timothy Gaitner. Representatives from President Bush's office were there, and they were trying to explain to the members of Congress something had happened, and the economy was very close. The entire financial system of the world was very close to buckling, because once the sun had crossed the Pacific, it would just be a cascade. The clock of the world would just go down. They stopped it from happening. And they, to this day, there's not really a good consensus on who pulled that money. But that was the beginning of what became the Great Recession, the deepest recession since the Great Depression. So, when I say there's going to be a financial crisis, listen to me. Right now, there's not. But here's the thing. This is stock chart. Stockcharts.com. I want to show you something. This will show you the real yield curve, okay? This would have been the yield curve, I believe, about 6 months out. Now watch what's been happening to the yield curve over the last 6 months. Do you see it? Notice that nice upward arch that it had there? But notice that it had a little bit of a problem. You see how it arched hard up here, but then it got flat pretty fast there. So in other words, 6 months ago, it was giving some kind of, the kind of things that at the time I was saying, that worries me. That looks like a curve that's trying to start an inversion run. Do you see what I was talking about? See how it arched, kicked, and then it flattens there like it's almost wanting to go up and then drop and then go back up again? Interestingly enough, though, now, oops, I tried. Do you see how it's calming down a lot? That would indicate to me that the risk of a recession has ebbed on it. There's not as much sentiment that interest rates will be highly volatile in the future. In other words, that maturity premium has smoothed itself out. Whereas back here, the markets were having a high expectation of a lot of interest rate volatility reflected in a maturity premium that was pretty stiff back in here. But once you get back to here, it's begun to smooth itself out. And now we're at the present time, and it doesn't look so bad. So any talk about a recession, you already now have a tool that you can use to look at the future, and also to know that the talk, there's some mention with whispers, well, there might be a recession around the corner. Don't see it. It's not there now. But you can look at it. Don't be one of those geeks who looks at it every day like I do. But look at it from week to week. And this is for your benefit, because it'll be, what, about a year, less than a year, maybe a year, you're going to be looking for a job. So you damn well better hope that that yield curve stays nice and pretty like it is now, because for at least another year or so, so that you are not walking out there into a recession. But at least now you have one tool that is one of the old tools of the trade, and it's still good to this day. It's time-honored. It's as old as dust, that tells you about recessions from the expectations of the market. This isn't the future, but this is as good as we can do. It's our expectation of it. That's all I have for you. I thank you.